FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
This episode of the Financial Survival Network is brought to you in part by Sandstorm Gold Royalties. Sandstorm Gold Royalties is a different kind of gold company. They purchase royalties on select mining operations and receive a percentage of the revenue in return. Sandstorm now has a portfolio of over 185 gold royalties around the world. See how gold royalties differ from other gold mining investments at sandstormgold.com. That's sandstormgold.com. Sandstorm Gold Royalties trades on the TSX as SSL and on the New York Stock Exchange American as SAND.
Welcome, and you are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz, and it's November 13th, 2018. Year is just flying by. Well, are we heading into a recession? Have higher interest rates wreaked their pain? And now we're going to see lower interest rates, according to Gary Schilling. Good question. Let's talk it over with Danielle Park, jugglingdynamite.com. Hey, as always, be a part of the show. Join us. The email address is kl@kerrylutz.com. Danielle, so good afternoon. Are we on our way to the Grand Recession again?
Well, we could be, but none of us would know it until after the fact, Kerry. That's the truth. So people are saying, well, you know, there's no sign of a recession, but there never is a sign of recession in classic indicators until well after it has usually ended, never mind started, by the time we notice it. It can also be, you know, we can already be in the recovery. What typically has happened in the last couple of downturns is the financial markets start to tank. And that precipitates the recession rather than the other way around. When you have an economy this levered, this indebted, it is the spike in interest rates which typically starts the financial crisis or the financial crunch, which then hits the economy rather than the opposite. So that's why I can never just say, you know, people today are saying, well, I don't see a recession, therefore I'm not worried about downside in the financial markets being significant at this point. And that's just flawed logic completely because, as I say, the recession indicators are never confirmed till after the fact. And by then you've already lost huge chunks of money if you're going by that. I would note that the Goldman Sachs bull bear market risk indicator, I don't know if you caught that today, Kerry, but it's out with its latest update and they take a composite of the ISM data, so that's manufacturing, right. The slope of the yield curve, core inflation, the unemployment rate, the price to earnings, the Shiller PE on stocks, and they put that all together. And the present reading is at 73% possibility or probability of a bear market. And that's higher than it was in both 2000 and in 2007. When it topped out at about 70. So we're at 73%. We haven't had a reading that high on this composite since the 65, 66 top when we had a nasty bear market and secular bear that ran from 66 to 82. So, you know, that's one of those things where at some point the readings and the it's like a compounding effect of all these negative factors, you know, the ill preparation in advance, the massive debt, the risk taking. And then you've got, as we've talked about many times, the central banks that have been hiking for 2 years. So, yes, they would hike if they could. They'd like to get back to a higher interest rate before the next downturn hits. But the reality is, and that's what Gary Schilling was just talking about in that clip I put on, is that they've already impacted the economy. We can already see a global slowdown in terms of consumption, demand, spending, commodities are tanking, you know, all this stuff, which gives you a sense of the real economy. And it looks like we're in that downturn period already without even further hikes.
Hey, and it's interesting that you say that because we're seeing real estate, sales of new homes going down. You know, when we hit the Depression, we started out, the rates were higher, and many speculate the Great Depression, I'm talking about in the 30s, that it occurred because the Fed rose increased rates and brought in a lot of money from Europe, and you know, they popped the bubble basically. And by 1940, interest rates, U.S. Treasury bond interest rates, were down to 2%. So that was right at the start of World War II. And, you know, now we actually saw, during this Great Recession, we saw the rates go down, and we're talking Treasury bond rates, down to under 2%, 10-year, I guess. I guess they must be comparing the 10-year, because they don't really issue 30-year bonds anymore. Mm-hmm. The point being that, you know, the behavior of interest rates wasn't that unusual during the Great Recession, that they would come down like that. What was unusual was that the amount of debt increased logarithmically during the Great Recession to now. It's been going up and up and up. And and then we see rates peak right around 1980, in the 1980s, and gradually went down ever since. So we're looking at really 30, almost 40 years of declining rates. And it just, you know, this chart is anomalous when you look at the 100-year chart where rates have come and gone during that time. I mean, that 18% rate, it was like 17.5, was just an all-time peak. So my point is, and there is a point here, that during great recessions, you're going to have a decrease in the demand for money. But we didn't really have a decrease in the demand for money from certain sectors, we did. But because of the government's monkeying in the economy, everything else kind of continued on as normal, and the debt continued to mount. So when you look at this chart, you got to think, like, what is going on here?
Well, securitization continued to boom. And, you know, that was the saving of the banks and the risk takers in 2008, and not clearing house. So because securitization took off again really quickly after the 08 collapse, we were able to, you know, that's been a massive force pushing down rates, because you've had the more fuel that central banks funneled into financial markets, the more excess capital and liquidity, the more it pooled into products, the more there was demand for, you know, yield products, the more loans that were available. So it really, if you look at it, since 2007, in the onset of the last crisis, corporate debt of non-financial companies has nearly tripled. Mm-hmm. So that just tells you that, again, that liquidity pooled in certain spots, and that's been all the Fed pumping. It didn't pool into the real economy and wage gains and that sort of thing. It pooled into levered risk taking and debt markets. And, you know, the interesting thing is, and this is why I talk about Canadian markets in terms of real estate being really one for the record books here, because, you know, we have had far worse metrics than you had at the peak of Euro 6 bust. You know, our amount of homes sitting empty is triple what you had at the peak, mm-hmm. in terms of percentages. Our leverage in the household is much higher, the amount of debt to household income much higher, debt to GDP, all these things. We have had just off the charts readings. And what's interesting is the last time we had that much credit growth and then a sort of a seizing of credit growth, which is what we're seeing right now, where real Canadian mortgage credit growth is about 1% right now. Mm-hmm. In September, it was. That's 70% lower than last year, Carrie, and way below the trend of the past decade. The last time we had that kind of a collapse was in 1980. The early part of the 80s, what happened was the credit had been widely abused. Then it, you know, peaked and contracted, and housing went from insanely overvalued and fell by 25% and 30% on average. That would be a mild outcome this time. And, you know, it's down in many areas already, but I think that the froth is just starting to come out. I think we're in for a bigger decline this time. And then what most people don't realize is, after that, as in the 80s, you get a decade typically of sideways or negative returns in real estate. So it doesn't bounce back.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right. And, you know, it might, like you said, it might not be the start of the recession, but it certainly could indicate that we're getting a lot closer to it than anybody wants to think. And like you say, there's not many people or many institutions that have been really effective in predicting economic cycles in advance. It's always, you know, the what's that, the Institute for Cycle Research or whatever, they're the ones that go back 2 years later and said, oh yeah, the recession started 2 years ago. Yeah, couldn't you tell? How did you not catch it?
Yeah, well, you know, in fairness, and I wrote about that in the blog this morning, we have been through such an unusual cycle. So many of the leading indicator composites, you know, Lachman-Osvuchon's work at ECRI, they actually did have a decent prediction or leading indicator model that gave them a heads up on past recessions. The problem was that in the last decade, we have had unprecedented central bank intervention. So because every time it turned down, and it did, carry, as you know, it turned down the economy and markets began to turn down in 10, they did it in 11, they did it again in 13, they did it in 15, 16. I mean, it started several times, which would have made sense from an organic growth perspective for the overall economy and what was legitimately investment capital available. But unfortunately, because they insisted on trying the next new experimental policy, the con men, so to speak, the heads of the central banks were leading with great confidence and trying to pump things up again. And so they really thwarted and stalled and elongated the cycle. And that made many people who have been reliably best, you know, pretty good at analysis look like Cassandras, you know, myself included. So, you know, I say that's fine. I have been, you know, early or looking at the indicators the past couple few years saying, geez, we ought to have a downturn anytime now. But then you get this next kick of adrenaline into the system. That doesn't mean that the measurements or the long-term indicators are no longer relevant. I would suggest it just means that they have been thwarted. Now, if you're banking on them being thwarted indefinitely by perpetual central bank intervention, especially at a time when they're already hiking and have hiked significantly, I think that starts to be a pretty precarious position for people to take. It's one thing to say, you know, well, you were early and it hasn't turned down when everyone thought that it was. So therefore, it's not going to turn down is, I think, a mistake.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. Because like you said, you just don't know when it's going to come. But almost certainly it is.
And the question, the more important question is not when is it going to come? The question is, are you prepared for it? Do you have a plan? That is the question. And most don't. And so they never want to contemplate the perspective of the natural recurring part of the down cycle that always comes eventually. They don't want to contemplate it because they don't have any plan and they weren't prepared for it and they aren't prepared for it.
Yeah.
That's what causes the harm.
Well, they weren't prepared in the first place when the economy collapsed in 08, 09, really in 07. And why should this time be any different?
Well, that's it. And that's why, you know, as I say, you're a decade older. What's your plan? You know, what's your plan? If it's painful because I know people are going to get hurt and it doesn't make me happy to know that. Mm-hmm. I know that most people won't have the time to make back their losses given the age and stage at which they find themselves coming into this downturn. And as I say, without quick fixes the next time, which I don't think the central banks will be able to deploy nearly as well in the next recovery, it could be a decade and more of down, sideways, and disappointing.
Yeah, no doubt. And they'll keep waiting for it to come back and come back because it always comes back, Danielle, right?
Well, and it will. And I'll be excited about buying when things are low. And I will see a good investment perspective over that the following years from there. It's just not from this point. It has to first do the downside correcting work and wipe out the speculators and the blind risk takers and the buy at every pricers because they deserve to be punished. Unfortunately, they've just not been thoughtful or careful about what they've been doing.
Hey, is there any indication that the so-called smart money is getting out of the market? I know insider sales have reached near records and records in some cases. Are there any other indicators that would show that smart money is exiting?
Yes, there's been a lot of fervor around initial public offerings. I mentioned that before in the pot space, how many companies are clamoring to get listed and trying to sell them their story to the public.
Yeah.
Of course, we saw that with the tech issuance in the past few years. Lots of mergers and acquisitions with with equities. In terms of the trading day, you see sort of a rally in the morning typically, and then a sell-off in the afternoon. And that typically suggests that there's that the institutional selling is trying to sell into strength. Algorithms are trying to contrive or create strength or the appearance of strength in the morning. But as soon as that hits, you see waves of selling come into the marketplace. I think there's a ton of pent-up selling, and we're seeing evidence of that, but people are having to sort of meet out their holdings. Now, this is institutional. This is strong hands to weak, sadly, because the retail crowd has been buying and buying dips indeed in the past 6 months.
So as usual, they're being set up for the fall.
Yes, unfortunately, yes. And they're setting themselves up for the fall because they're not doing the right things.
Yeah, well, some things never change, Danielle. You know, market cycles, we'd like to think they've been abolished. And business cycle, we'd like to think we're so smart that we can eliminate it. And yet, you know, the business cycle lives on. Look, the business cycle existed before there were central banks. People like to think that the good old days, we didn't have central banks monkeying with interest rates, and therefore, you know, the cycle went on. But there's always cycles of extreme speculation, exuberance, followed by crashes. I mean, I was giving a speech, a talk at a conference recently, and I went over the history of bubbles. So if you look at the Dow Jones, you look at the stock indices, they don't really look like a conventional bubble. They really don't. They haven't gone exponential per se. So you can't call them a bubble, but you certainly can say they're overvalued and long-lived in the perspective of historical precedents that, you know, this is the oldest bull market that we've had. So you got to take some notice of it. But other things, you know, have turned into bubbles, and it's quite obvious in retrospect, like cryptocurrencies. And people keep thinking they're coming back. They're going to go to 250,000 or whatever, and it's just not going to happen. It just
isn't. You know, it's interesting that you say that, because I understand what you're saying. This is not the NASDAQ doubling in 1 year like it did in 1999, as an example. However, if you look at the chart of the broad-based S&P 500, which has been the quadrupling from the 09 bottom, the most, you know, successful market recovery in this cycle in the entire world, if you look at that on a relative strength indicator, it was at 90 on a monthly reading, Carrie. 90. That is what we saw at the sort of the tech bubble top in 2000. And we saw it briefly in 2007. It's been longer in the nosebleed territory, relative strength, meaning wildly overbought, overlevered on that indicator. And I think that, you know, the period from 2015 to today, if you look at that long-term chart, which again, I put on the blog this morning, it really shows that leg, that limb, it may not be straight up, but it's pretty much on a parabolic style. Mm-hmm. And I think it ought not to have happened at all. It was euphoric pump on the Trump tax cut stuff when all the indications are that money went directly into share buybacks, which of course is a self-fulfilling prophecy for why the S&P kept going up over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
But now, even the Republicans and people who are in favor of that tax cut package are admitting that, hey, it really didn't trickle into the real economy the way we hoped, the way I said it wouldn't in the first place, because it wasn't being driven by actual demand and infrastructure investment and spending. It was being driven into financial engineering. So anyway, I think that is arguably evidence of a bubble. I think the Canadian housing market has that evidence of bubble-like qualities. Sure. And in some of your real estate markets in the past couple of years, you've definitely had bubble-ish properties. So
inflated, yes, but in terms of a real bubble, not so much. You know,
here's just one thought for you. When you're in a period where just one asset class has had outrageous gains, it stands out more than when you're in a period where many asset classes have had outrageous gains. So relative to each other, it's like a mountain range. You know, if one hill's super high and the rest are lower, it's easy to see that one is super high. But when a whole bunch of things are super high, it may be less easy to discern.
Well, the conventional chart is what I'm talking about. It could be overbought, over-leveraged, no question about it, but it hasn't behaved like the traditional bubble. That's all I'm saying. You know, in terms of magnitude of rise, the speed of the rise, and the inevitable decline. So, yes, inflated and overpriced, overvalued for sure. But in terms of being a bubble, you know, when we really study the bubbles over the past 400 years, going back to the Dutch, you know, so-called tulip mania, much different. So doesn't
could
mean
be,
the results.
And then you have to ask yourself, and what flows from that? What is the relevance of that assessment? And, you know, at this point, I would say the relevance is, what downside exposure is it likely to have, whether you call it a bubble or not? The point is, you know, tech stocks dropped 78%. Commodity stocks dropped 78%-ish after the 2007 top. Many housing prices came off 60%. So whether you call them a bubble or not, the point is the downside is profound. And I think the downside today is profound as well.
For sure. You know, just the numbers that at play are larger than ever before. The amounts invested, the amounts risked, and that the average market participant isn't even aware that you're risking your money in the market now is a really bad thing, for sure. My only contention is it's not like, you know, it's not like Bitcoin. It's not like tulip mania. That doesn't mean you can't lose money and that it's not a dangerous place to be, because it certainly is. But in any event, that's it for this week. And hey, we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks, Danielle. Make sure you check out Danielle's site, jugglingdynamite.com, our site, financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Feel free to send us an email, kl@carrylutz.com, Twitter feed @CarrieLutz, and the Facebook page, Financial Survival Network. Danielle, we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Thanks, Carrie.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.